just have to budget even more. A can of beans has to be cut in half to be able to make it. And with the holidays coming up, that's insane.
The Trump administration says it will restart SNAP food benefits, but will only pay a portion of what recipients usually get.
For Monday, November 3rd, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump plans to cap the number of refugees entering the U.S. at the lowest level in history.
Meanwhile, the administration will prioritize white Afrikaners.
What we're doing is we're closing ourselves off from the rest of the world at our own detriment, economically, culturally, and honestly, morally.
Also, NBA writer Sam Smith and coach Phil Jackson have teamed up on a new book about the history of professional basketball.
Sam has taken me by the nape of my neck and said the NBA has just passed its 75th anniversary.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. The Trump administration says it will restart federal food assistance during the government shutdown, but recipients will only get half of what they normally receive. The administration had said it would not use a contingency fund for the program during the shutdown, but announced the changes after court rulings last week. As NPR's Windsor Johnston reports, millions of people depend on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP.
The threat of missing SNAP benefits is sending a wave of anxiety through low-income families, many of whom already live on the edge. Mental health experts say the stress isn't just about food, it's about fear. Martha Wadsworth is a professor of psychology at Penn State University. She says the shutdown is re-traumatizing for people who've already endured poverty, displacement, and instability.
It increases stress, and we know stress has effects on the brain. And for kiddos who are hungry, who have food insecurity, it affects their sleep. It's hard to sleep when you're hungry.
If benefits lapse, experts say it won't just be hunger, it will be a mental health crisis. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
A pair of new lawsuits are trying to stop the Trump administration from making a big change to the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. NPR's Corey Turner explains.
PSLF, as it's known, was created by Congress in 2007 and offers borrowers a quid pro quo. Work in public service for 10 years, and the government will erase your federal student loans. Now, though, the administration says starting in July, it will deny forgiveness to employers that engage in activities with substantial illegal purpose. Today's lawsuits, filed by a host of Democratic-leaning cities, counties, and states, argue the Education Department could use this rule to punish places that defy the administration's positions on immigration, equity, or gender-affirming care. The department has insisted the rule, quote, provides strong, clear standards anchored in law, not ideology. Corey Turner, NPR News.
A federal judge has blocked National Guard deployments to Oregon for several more days. As Oregon Public Broadcasting's Conrad Wilson reports, the judge said she needs more time to review evidence from a trial that ended last week.
U.S. District Court Judge Karen Emmerich's block on the Trump administration deploying the National Guard to Oregon extends until 5 p.m. on Friday. She said she needs time to review hundreds of exhibits and additional arguments. This new order is the latest in a months-long legal battle over the president's efforts to send Guard members to Portland. Emmerich's decision on Sunday is not final, but it suggests she's likely to side with the states of Oregon and California and the city of Portland. They've sued to block the deployment, saying President Trump's actions are unlawful and a violation of state sovereignty. For NPR News, I'm Conrad Wilson in Portland.
NVIDIA and other AI stocks propped up Wall Street today, with the S&P 500 rising about 0.2%. This is NPR News from Washington. The first clinical trial is underway to see if transplanting pig kidneys into people might really save lives. United Therapeutics produces gene-edited pig kidneys and says the study's initial transplant was performed successfully. The longest-lasting known transplant so far was 271 days. A famine in Sudan has spread to two regions of the country, according to a global hunger monitoring organization. The more than two-year civil war has caused the world's largest humanitarian crisis, as NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu reports.
The Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, said famine had been detected in Al-Fashir, in the western region of Darfur. 20 other areas in Darfur and Kordofan are also at risk of famine, according to the IPC. Both regions are at the center of the conflict between the Rapid Support Forces and the Sudanese army that has devastated Sudan, displacing more than 13 million people. There is no definitive death toll. But last year, the US said as many as 150,000 people may have been killed. Al-Fashir had been under siege by the RSF for 18 months until late October when it took over the city. The siege cut off food and medical supplies to thousands trapped there. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Lagos.
Actress Diane Ladd has died. She was 89 years old. Her daughter, Laura Dern, called her an amazing hero and profound gift of a mother. Ladd's career spanned decades and earned 3 Academy Award nominations for Best Supporting Actress for performances in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, Wild at Heart, and Rambling Rose. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Cy Sims Foundation. Since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
406 All Things Considered on KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton. Up next, we are learning about federal food assistance programs. I'll learn more about resources available in northern Minnesota. Check out kaxe.org. Our thanks goes out to Itasca Economic Development Corporation. They create and retain quality jobs in Itasca County. ItascaDV.org. Be careful out there. Gusty west winds paired with dry conditions are leading to near-critical fire weather conditions now.
Considered from NPR News, I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The Trump administration says it will restart SNAP food benefits, but people will only get half of their normal amount, and it could be a while before they even get that money. The government's decision comes after 2 federal judges ruled last week that freezing payments for the country's largest anti-hunger program is likely unlawful. NPR's Jennifer Ludden joins us now with more. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so this sounds like a bit of a mixed bag here. We've got some good news, some bad news for people who rely on SNAP. Like, why does the administration say it will only pay half of what people are eligible for?
Because it is tapping a contingency fund that 2 federal judges ruled was explicitly meant for this kind of emergency.
Okay.
But the administration says there's only $4.5 billion in there, and that's roughly half of the $8 billion in SNAP payments that go to people every month. Now, the judges had also ruled the Trump administration could legally tap a much larger source of money from customs revenues, and that would fund full SNAP payments. But the administration declined to do it. It said that could take money away from child nutrition programs. The idea of only partially funding SNAP did not please some of those who'd filed these legal challenges. And Brett Smiley, the mayor of Providence, Rhode Island, said, you know, this should never have taken a lawsuit in the first place.
And while it's a victory for decency, fairness, and for every community working hard, it is not something that we should have had to do in the first place. The suspending food aid is cruel. And to threaten the stability of families who are already struggling is wrong.
The head of the nonprofit Democracy Forward, which helped bring one of the lawsuits, said that group was considering all legal options to secure full payment.
Okay, well, in the meantime, the next big question is, do we have a sense of how soon people might get even these partial payments?
We do not. I will say this money, the way it goes out is complicated. Uh-huh. It goes from the federal government to states, then through contractors onto the debit-like cards that people use to buy food. And recalculating for partial payments does take time. But in its court filing, the administration said it could be weeks, if not months, especially, it said, in some states with decades-old systems. So it leaves this possibility that people in some states might see benefits before others.
Wow. I mean, let's just be very clear, Jennifer. You have reported that 1 out of 8 people in the U.S. rely on SNAP. That's something like 42 million people, right? Like, where does all of this leave them?
It's leaving a lot of people very worried. I met some yesterday here in D.C., the District of Columbia, in a long line that stretched down the street at Northwest Community Food Pantry. I spoke with G. Wilson. She's 64, an Army veteran, and disabled. She always gets her SNAP benefits at the start of the month. She said she had checked, and there was nothing on her card. And that leaves a gaping hole in her budget, she said, and you can't stretch what you don't have.
With the assistance of these food banks, who they themselves are running out of food, we just have to budget even more. A can of beans has to be cut in half to be able to make it. You no longer can have a full serving. And with the holidays coming up, that's insane.
I know I should add that D.C. and a few states are using their own emergency funds to fill this gap, so it's possible G may still get her money.
But I want to ask you, I mean, you said that the administration is spending all of the contingency fund for these partial SNAP payments to cover just November. So what happens if this federal shutdown extends into December?
That's a really good question and hard to say. If the administration sticks to its position that there's no other money it can use, despite what two judges have ruled, we could again see this food aid disappear. And it's worth noting, you know, this is a program Republicans and President Trump have long wanted to shrink. And in fact, this summer, Republicans did pass what will be the biggest budget cuts in SNAP's history.
That is NPR's Jennifer Ludden. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
And if you or someone you know is in need of groceries right now, perhaps for the first time in their lives, here are some resources. Feeding America is a national network of food banks. Just visit feedingamerica.org to find one close to you. You might also qualify for the Federal Emergency Food Assistance Program, or TFAP. The income limits are often higher than for SNAP benefits. And what the program does is it buys food from farms that state and local agencies then distribute free of charge. The Trump administration paused about $500 million of funding to TFAP earlier this year, but the program is still operating. Just look up TFAP and your state to see distribution locations.
Every year, the President of the United States determines how many refugees can enter this country. The law says he must consult Congress on this number, but last week, President Trump went ahead without Congress and made it official. The U.S. will allow just 7,500 refugees into this country in the next year, and that is the lowest since the program started. And the administration has said white Afrikaners from South Africa would be prioritized. Sharif Ali leads the International Refugee Assistance Project, an organization that helps refugees and other immigrants navigate the legal process of resettlement. And he joins us here in studio. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you so much for having me.
So just on a very practical level, where does this leave the thousands of refugees who are already in the pipeline to come here to the United States?
It really leaves them in shambles, quite frankly. They are currently have went through a very extraordinary vetting process to come into the United States. We have clients that have been calling us that have been in tears. They just want to come to safety after years of persecution and conflict.
The law that established the current system of refugee admissions in this country is something called the Refugee Act of 1980. Can you just walk us through what that law guarantees refugees?
Well, the law allows for refugees to come into the United States through a process that includes a vetting process that also includes a determination by the president of where refugees are coming from. After going through that process, there is a resettlement agency that helps facilitate that settlement into the United States. That resettlement process is approximately 6 months to a year. Refugees are provided support for housing, English as second language learning, opportunities for employment, and support from local communities to help them integrate into society.
And part of that law, as I understand it, it requires that the president consult Congress on the number of refugees that he determines should be let into the United States, which this administration did not do. The Trump administration says that's because the government is currently shut down. Do we expect lawsuits?
I can't tell you right now. However, it is a complete movement away from historical precedent and the law. The law actually requires the president and his cabinet members to consult with Congress. So therefore, I do anticipate there will be a challenge to this. I cannot tell you who or what, but I do anticipate a challenge.
What do you say to those who might make the case that it shouldn't be America's job to take in refugees?
There's a challenge right now with how people are scapegoating refugees and immigrants for the problems that exist in America today. If they are economic problems, refugees contribute economically. If people are afraid of their safety, refugees are the most vetted immigrants that come into the United States. If people are concerned about the change in their culture, if you look at any major city across the U.S., you are enjoying the cuisine of people who have come into this country from a variety of different places. You're enjoying the art, the music, the contribution to those communities. And what we're doing is we're closing ourselves off from the rest of the world at our own detriment. Economically, culturally, and honestly, morally. This is a humanitarian commitment that we've established in the 1980 Refugee Act, something that has been based in our American values of welcoming people, regardless of what they have went through, to find a new home in America to be a place for their safety, a place for their contribution.
Now, there have been, of course, waves of refugees at various points across U.S. history, but am I correct that this is the first time that one ethnic group has been given preference? And we're, of course, talking about the white Afrikaners from South Africa, which are the same group that implemented apartheid in that country.
That is correct. And this is one of the concerns that the resettlement agencies have. We're not here to discuss the validity of Afrikaners, but what is afforded to them should be afforded to all people, considering that they are the most vetted people that come into this country. So the concern that many in our space have, including our organization, is that we're basically putting a door to all those who are not Afrikaners to this country, which really incites concerns about racism and xenophobia.
Sharif, as you think about these new restrictions on refugees in the U.S., is there someone that comes to mind that you think about who you worked with in the past who maybe wouldn't be able to come into the United States now?
Yeah, actually, there's quite a few. But one of them that I'll share with you is one of our clients that is currently part of the Pasito versus Trump case. His name is Pasito. And he is a father who fled from Congo with his wife and daughter. And after the January 21st, they were told that they were no longer going to be able to take their flight coming into the U.S. And they had shared with us that they felt like after so many doors had been closed in front of their faces, they finally thought when they got approval to travel that they were going to embark on a journey to a new home. And this is after years of fleeing violence in Congo, staying in Kenya to try to settle themselves. And they finally were told that, no, your travel is not allowed into the U.S. Thankfully, due to the injunction we received early on in the Pasito versus Trump case, he was one of the 80 individuals that was allowed to come into the U.S. And that litigation is ongoing. However, he has communicated to us and told us, you know, how thankful and grateful he is that he's been able to come into the U.S. He's so thankful that his daughter is able to go to school now without fear for her safety, that him and his wife are able to pursue work and opportunities to have a dignified life here in the U.S. And the amount of gratitude that I've seen from him, and along with so many other refugees, just indicates the passion that they have and commitment to serve in the U.S. in a manner that any person here would be proud to have them as their neighbor.
We've been speaking with Sharif Ali, president of the International Refugee Assistance Project. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 4:18 and you are tuned into All Things Considered here on People Powered KAXE. Coming up, we've got our daily dose of phonology with John Latimer and Masters of the Game, the longtime friendship of NBA coaching legend Phil Jackson and writer Sam Smith. Got increasing clouds tonight with lows 30 to 33, west winds 5 to 10 with gusting up to 20 miles an hour. Right now, the gusting west winds paired with the dry conditions we are experiencing are leading to near critical fire weather conditions. Be cautious.
On today's date, November 3rd, 1991, most of northern Minnesota, in fact, most of the state of Minnesota, is just beginning to dig out from what was then called the storm of the century. We received 15 inches of snow here in Grand Rapids. In Duluth, they had 37 inches of snow, and down in Minneapolis, 25 inches of snow, all on a snowstorm that began on the 31st of October and truly was still snowing on the 3rd of November. This was a record-breaking snow by every measure. And many, many, many animals and humans were caught out and really weren't quite ready for winter quite that early. I had observations of robins and ruffed grouse sharing the apple trees in my yard. And many of those robins, I'm sure, were thinking, why on earth did I stay here this long?
NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Capital One, offering their dining and entertainment card, Saver. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. In the early 1970s, writer Sam Smith was just a fan sitting up in the balconies of Madison Square Garden.
And getting a beautiful feed from Lucas.
Down on the court was a young Phil Jackson playing for the New York Knicks.
Phil was dribbling the ball and we were all yelling, Phil, pass it to somebody. Please, pass it.
Jackson would go on to become a legendary NBA coach, and he and Smith would one day become friends, brought together by one of the greatest basketball players who ever played.
Jordan, open!
Serendipity, happenstance, he ends up getting hired by the Bulls, and I end up being the beat writer on basketball. And, 35 years later, we figured out something to do.
And now they've written a book together, a look back at the 75 greatest players in the history of the NBA. It's called Masters of the Game.
Sam has, taken me by, the nape of my neck in retirement and said, what do you think we talk about 75 for 75?
The book is a celebration of the league's history.
Americans aren't great in history in general. I think there's a lack of appreciation of how talented these players were. They had second jobs. Well, the reason they had second jobs is they weren't making much money.
The number two scorer in the NBA at 6'5", 220 pounds, from the Cincinnati Royals, Oscar Robertson.
Oscar Robertson. I worked for Pepsi, but Oscar Robertson could play in any era. Phil played in that era. He coached. I saw those players play and know how talented they were. Elgin Baylor, Bill Russell. And I always think it's important, especially to know their history.
But when we spoke about the book, I had to ask about the player both Jackson and Smith know best, Michael Jordan.
Well, he has a sickness. It's called competitiveness. Michael wasn't the greatest shooter, certainly not when he came up. And certainly players rebounded, played defense, Bill Russell. People passed the ball better. So how is it that, in these debates, Michael could be considered the greatest of all time? And it was this incredible mindset he had toward competition, to committing to the game. We sort of talk about it now. Players take off, miss games. And I know Phil probably remember this. Michael used to come through the trainer's room and make sure everybody was out on the court. None of this sitting around, and that was just for practice.
And Phil, I know that you coach Jordan and were there when he won all six of his championships. Yet in the book, you said something that sort of really surprised me, that you say you mostly stayed away from Michael. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship that the two of you had as player and coach and what it was like sort of being around and having the ability to work with a superstar with that sort of star power?
It was an age when we were still flying commercial hotels that were, Marriott's, et cetera. And, I was on the top floor with Michael, and there were maybe six people in the hotel staff standing outside his room waiting to get an autograph. A waitress and a waiter and a guy who was, baggage claim kid and so forth. And it was a myriad of pressures that went into this young athlete that had really very little protection. So I kept away from him and let him have his private life because I think that was the most valuable thing for him to have.
So much of this book takes a look back at the history of the league, but I'm curious for each of you, what do you hope for the future of the NBA?
Maybe less gambling apps for the current time. I know Phil and I talk about it in the book, some of the rules that, have sort of been eased so much. Traveling and palming. If you look back and compare the way the players played the game, I think somewhat lack of fundamentals. If there's sort of a melding of some of the great parts of the history of the game, as well as the great athleticism and brilliance of some of these players now, it's some combination with the past. I'd love to see that.
I think we become kind of stagnant in the game, and you know, the players have grown into a game that's, the court's too small for them. This court needs to be much longer, but at least 10 feet or more, so the game becomes a running game again, and it's become stagnant, and three-point line has become, you know, kind of like a characteristic of this game. It's a three-point shooting game.
Last thing, Phil, I do want to ask you, having now written this book alongside Sam Smith and talked about all of these incredible players, how do you think about your own legacy as a part of the league?
Wow. Unbelievable. Lucky. And, you know, the period of time that I was able to coach has become like legendary. That era, I think it's over. You know, that's part of what basketball is, you know, examining the history of the game and looking back and looking forward to what can happen in the future with the game.
That's NBA coach Phil Jackson and journalist Sam Smith. Their new book is called Masters of the Game. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The company that makes Tylenol is being bought by the consumer giant Kimberly-Clark. They make Huggies diapers and Kleenex tissues. It's one of the biggest acquisitions of the year, worth almost $49 billion. And it comes just weeks after the Trump administration put Tylenol in the headlines, making an unproven link between the drug and autism. NPR's Alina Selyukh reports.
You're probably familiar with Kimberly-Clark because of its paper products, like Cottonelle and Scott toilet paper. They also make Kotex and Depends. And its purchase of Kenvue, which makes Tylenol, is a leap onto more drugstore shelves. Announcing the deal on video, Kimberly-Clark CEO Michael Hsu said buying Kenvue would speed up its ambition
to become a stronger and faster health and wellness company.
Kenvue has actually been on the selling block for a long while. Its stock had been falling for months. And Kimberly-Clark is not such a strange suitor. It's been trying to challenge the Goliath in its field, Procter & Gamble, which makes everything from laundry detergent to skincare to over-the-counter medicine. And Kenvue will give Kimberly-Clark a lot of familiar brands. It makes Band-Aids and Neosporin, Listerine and Zyrtec, Neutrogena and Aveeno. And of course, the new elephant in the room.
So taking Tylenol.
That's President Trump about a month ago.
Is not good. All right, I'll say it. It's not good.
He said that pregnant women taking acetaminophen, which is the generic name for Tylenol, raised the risk of autism in the baby. There's no clear scientific evidence for this claim, and Kenvue immediately said this was false. The controversy was not mentioned in the deal announcement, but analysts on a call with executives asked about risks, including Tylenol-related lawsuits. Here's what Kenvue CEO Kirk Perry said.
We stand firmly behind the science and the safety of our products.
Kimberly-Clark's chief executive said the company board had consulted with scientific, medical, regulatory, and legal experts. In the end, deciding the chance to buy Kenvue was a, quote, generational opportunity. Alina Selyukh, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's 4:29 and you're listening to KAXC, People Powered Radio in Northern Minnesota. Up next, National Native News. In a historic moment, the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration have transferred land to the Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. Hear the story coming up next. We'll also bring you an hour from now, local news, the Up North Report. Our listeners love supporting the businesses that support KEXC. If you are interested in connecting with KEXC and you have a business, call 218-326-1234 to learn about sponsorship opportunities. Big thanks to all of our current business supporters. That includes Bemidji Brewing. They offer rotating taproom exclusive beers and crowlers to go. The latest offerings available Tuesday through Thursday, 2 to 10, Friday, Saturday, 11 to 10, and Sunday, 11 to 7. BemidjiBeer.com, Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Increasing clouds tonight, lows 30 to 33 with west winds 5 to 10, gusting up to 20, and a slight chance of rain early, then cloudy tomorrow. Highs 50 to 54 degrees.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In a historic moment, the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration have transferred land to the Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. As Danielle Kading reports, it's the first known land transfer nationwide from a Catholic institution to a tribal nation in the name of reparations.
The transfer aims to repair the painful legacy of federal Indian boarding schools. From the early 19th century until 1969, Native American children were removed from their homes and forced to assimilate. The Franciscan Sisters transferred its Mary Wood Franciscan Spirituality Center in Arborvitae to Lac du Flambeau. Araya Breedlove, the tribe's spokesperson, says it's a significant moment.
Having this be the first time, as we know of at least, that any institution has given land back in regards to reparations, it's rare that we see the acknowledgement of that hurt and the generational trauma.
Sue Ernster is president of the Franciscan Sisters.
We do see this as the beginning of deepening the relationship and really helping to heal our part of the trauma.
The band purchased the property for $30,000. While the Spirituality Center was never a boarding school, the Franciscan Sisters ran St. Mary's Catholic Indian Boarding School on the Bad River Tribes Reservation in Wisconsin. Officials with the Lac du Flambeau Tribe say they're grateful for the sisters' kindness and willingness to acknowledge the hurt and trauma from boarding schools. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
A Kodiak-based nonprofit dedicated to supporting families with newborns is expanding into the Northwest Arctic borough. KMXT's Davis Hovey reports on how Kodiak Kindness is helping families across Alaska raise babies.
For years, Noya Kwanda Baltazar has been teaching infants in Kotzebue through a local program that serves children with disabilities or delayed development. It's the only such program based out of a school district in the state. Baltazar says it's about helping kids from birth to 3 years old and their families around the Manelik service area, which covers 12 communities in northwest Alaska from Kotzebue to Kobuk.
Working with birth to three, it's always good about helping families, ensuring that they're strong, supported, and any way we can support families and nursing moms to help their babies grow, I think is great.
Baltazar and Francis Williams from Ambler are bringing their experience working with children to Kodiak Kindness as they continue doing what they already do, but under the new title of peer counselors. Williams, who is known in her hometown as the village mother, says being part of the organization will give her more support and tools to do things she already does on a regular basis in the Northwest Arctic community.
Kodiak Kindness would be able to help because there's a lot of things that I learned when we went to the trainings. Things that we didn't know. So all the training will be able to help. Like, I'll be able to do my own mix, you know, with Kodiak Kindness and my Inupiaq traditions.
Williams says she uses native plants like stinkweed or spruce trees to make salves or other traditional medicines to help her friends, family, and neighbors heal from the land. Aside from the traditional knowledge Williams has from her mom and aunties, she'll also be able to help her community with assistance from a certified lactation consultant if she wants support virtually from the Kodiak Kindness team via telehealth. Kodiak Kindness's two new peer counselors in the Northwest Arctic borough come online this winter and hope to start enrolling families in the region early next year. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Davis Hovey.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com. Support by AARP, whose Family Caregiver Resource Guide is available to caregivers by calling 877-333-5885 or at aarp.org/caregiver resources.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Tomorrow is Election Day. It's not a presidential election or a midterm congressional election, but some key races around the country could have national consequences. NPR's Domenico Montanaro takes a look at those contests through their ads.
There are four big races with national implications. Two of them are for governor, including in Virginia. Here's Democrat Abigail Spanberger.
Now I'm ready to serve again as governor, to continue our family's tradition of service by serving all Virginia families.
Republican Winsome Earl Sears is taking a different approach.
As your governor, I won't be a polished politician, but as a United States Marine, I'll always fight for Virginia.
In New Jersey, it's Democratic Congresswoman Mikey Sherrill stressing her military credentials.
As a Navy helicopter pilot, I learned accountability, that leaders always put the people they serve first. I'm Mikey Sherrill.
She's running against Republican Jack Cittarelli, a former state legislator who's run and lost twice before for governor.
Together, I know we can fix New Jersey. It's time.
Then there's the election for mayor of New York. The Republican in the race is Curtis Sliwa, a perennial mayoral candidate running on familiar GOP turf.
Our schools failing, riots, defunding the police, crime, and corruption.
We should. Former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is running as an independent after losing the Democratic primary.
You may not always agree with Andrew Cuomo, but you gotta admit, he knows what he's doing.
He'd kick anybody's ass standing in the way.
Standing in his way is Democratic rising star Zohran Mamdani.
We can tell Donald Trump he cannot buy this election. And we can tell Andrew Cuomo that New York City is not for sale.
A self-proclaimed Democratic socialist, Mamdani has captured the imagination of progressives. But he's also become a lightning rod on the right. Conservatives have labeled him radical for criticisms of Israel and for tweets advocating for the defunding of police. As a candidate for mayor, though, he's disavowed his past stance on police and says safety is a top priority. And in the final days of the race, he launched an ad on Fox News taking on his detractors. It opens with clips of him being criticized on the network, but then this.
Socialist, don't rant, Mamdani.
He is a communist.
Hey, I'm the actual Zohran Mamdani, not the guy they talk about on this channel.
He's made some big promises to freeze the rent, make buses faster, and provide universal child care. If he wins and polls show he's favored, getting those things done is going to be a major test. Whether they work may indicate just how far Democrats are willing to run with his message nationally. On the other side of the country is a battle with potentially huge consequences for control of the House.
Vote yes on Prop 50.
Stop Newsom's power grab. Vote no.
In response to President Trump pushing for Texas to redraw districts and try and gain as many as five new Republican seats to shore up control of the House next year, California Governor Democrat Gavin Newsom is trying to do the same. But to do it, he needs the state to vote in favor of Proposition 50, which would temporarily overturn the independent drawing of districts that's currently mandated by the state. Newsom is getting some high-profile help.
Republicans want to steal enough seats in Congress to rig the next election and wield unchecked power for two more years.
Yep, that's former President Barack Obama, who remains popular within the Democratic base, and he's also cut ads for Spanberger and Sherrill. But the current president, Donald Trump, is the one on the lips of Democrats in these races. Take this one from Spanberger that ties her GOP opponent to Trump's policies.
What does she say about Trump's bad budget bill?
The bill, as you know now, does so many great things.
What?
The Trump in New Jersey, Sherrill says of her costs. Republican opponent.
MAGA's coming for New Jersey with Trump-endorsed Republican Jack Cittarelli. Trump brags Cittarelli is now 100% MAGA. We've got to stop him. With Democrats.
Cittarelli's response?
We all know it. New Jersey's a mess. And all Mike Sherr wants to talk about is President Trump. Come on. What does the president have to do with rising property taxes and higher electricity bills? New Jersey's a mess because...
Republicans in these races have largely steered clear of Trump, focusing more on things like crime. But off-year elections tend to test the party in power and give voters aligned with the party out of power their first chance to register their frustration. Domenico Montanaro, NPR News, Washington.
Okay, let's zoom in now on the race for New York City mayor. More than 730,000 people cast ballots in early voting, according to election officials. In the closing days of his campaign, the frontrunner, Zoran Mamdani, has organized a massive get-out-the-vote effort. Meanwhile, former Democratic governor Andrew Cuomo is running as an independent, hoping to come from behind with support from Black and Jewish voters. NPR's Brian Mann reports.
When Zoran Mamdani launched his campaign for mayor last year, he was a relative unknown, a backbencher in New York State Legislature. But by this weekend, he had built a movement. Surrounded by a massive crowd in Queens, he urged volunteers to go door-to-door rallying votes.
We want the next 3 days to be days where we do not sleep. Yeah! Days where we leave everything out in the field. Days that we can look back on and say we did everything we could. Are you ready for those days?
Yeah! Using viral social media videos and drawing on New York City's left-leaning street protest culture, Mamdani has led this race by double digits in the polls. Part of his appeal is a populist economic message. Here's one of his ads.
We all want more money in our pocket, more dignity in our lives, more rest and joy in this wild, beautiful city.
If he wins, Mamdani would be New York City's first Muslim mayor. While reaching out to Jewish leaders in the city, he's also been critical of Israel's war in Gaza, a view that polls show is popular with a majority of younger voters here. Daria Lisa is 31 years old. She's been knocking on doors for Mamdani.
The fact that Zoran has not just taken the stand on Palestine, but also has done so for so much of his life, to me, told me everything I needed to know about trusting him on other issues.
While Mamdani was rallying big crowds to make his closing arguments, his chief rival, Andrew Cuomo, was working the aisles in a grocery store in Queens, meeting with much smaller and mostly older groups of Black and Hispanic voters.
How are you? Good to see you.
Good seeing you.
Need you to vote, and I wish you good luck.
Thank you, sir.
During the Democratic primary, which he lost, Cuomo drew strong support from older Black voters like Samuel Hill, who says he'll cast his ballot for Cuomo tomorrow.
He's a good candidate for anything because he's a good man.
But in this race, Cuomo is trying to revive a political career derailed by scandal. Cuomo resigned as governor in 2021 after women came forward accusing him of sexual harassment. He also faced criticism for his handling of elderly nursing home residents during the COVID pandemic. A report by New York's Attorney General's office accused the Cuomo administration of underreporting nursing home deaths. Cuomo has repeatedly denied any wrongdoing and tried to put that history behind him. During this final weekend, he described himself as staunchly pro-Israel and a pro-business alternative to Mamdani's democratic socialism. Once a champion of progressive criminal justice reforms, including cashless bail and closing of prisons, he's running now as a law and order candidate, including a promise to hire more cops for the NYPD.
Homeowners in Queens, families who have children, they need public safety first. 5,000 police officers, I will make it a reality.
The outcome of this race tomorrow could be heavily influenced by the third candidate on the ballot, Republican Curtis Sliwa. Sliwa is running a distant third, but polls suggest he's likely to win many of the conservative votes that Cuomo would need in order to catch Mamdani. Brian Mann, NPR News, in Queens, in New York City.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered here on KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton. Coming up next, it's North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live. Today, they're looking at rights and rules at the polls. Tomorrow is Election Day, And you can check out our website, the election section. There are Minnesota school referendums that are seeking budget and building fixes. Total of 13 districts in rural northern Minnesota are asking residents to support the referendums in special elections this year. Programming on KEXE KBXE is supported in part by the Minnesota Humanities Center, distributing more than $6 million in cultural heritage grants. Funds are available to individuals and organizations that will create, celebrate, and teach the art, culture, and heritage of the state's diverse culture. That includes, but is not limited to, Indigenous organizations, historically underrepresented communities, recent immigrant communities, and veterans. Application and deadline information is online at mnhum.org/grants.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's segment, the state is investing in revitalizing old properties. Then, a group of students fights a federal lawsuit. And as the election day approaches, know your rights and rules at the polls. I'm Gracie J. The Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development is investing nearly $2.3 million to revitalize five sites across the state. The projects will create or retain 269 jobs, add $2.4 million to local tax bases, and spur more than $157 million in private investment. The state will transform nearly 34 acres and create 488 new housing units. The department says the programs help communities breathe new life into old properties and strengthen local economies. Next, Minnesota's DREAM Act has helped hundreds of undocumented students pay in-state tuition for more than a decade. Now, the federal government says it violates federal rules. Zan Holston has more.
This summer, the Department of Justice, or DOJ, sued Minnesota over its DREAM Act, a state law that provides a path for undocumented immigrant students to pay in-state college tuition rates if they meet certain requirements. The DOJ is accusing Minnesota of violating a 1996 federal law that bans states from giving undocumented students access to college financial aid on the basis of residency unless it offers the same benefits to all U.S. citizens, regardless of whether they live in that state.
We know that the federal government has made it a priority to attack and villainize immigrants of all stripes, and in particular, undocumented immigrants.
That's Minnesota Assistant Attorney General Joe Ritchie. He said the state law was written carefully to stay within the limits of federal law. Eligibility for the Minnesota DREAM Act isn't based on state residency, but whether a student attended a Minnesota high school for 3 years and meets other academic and filing requirements.
Nobody thought this was an issue until now, and I think that speaks volumes.
Minnesota is far from the only state with a DREAM Act. Texas was the first to pass one back in 2001 under Republican Governor Rick Perry. And since then, more than 20 other states have followed suit.
And if you look at the states that enacted laws enabling people to go to get an affordable college education, regardless of immigration status, it's blue and red states altogether. It was not a partisan issue.
Still, the DOJ has recently taken aim at DREAM Act states, including Texas, Oklahoma, and Kentucky. The attorneys general in those three states agreed to end their programs instead of going to trial, effectively conceding before any judge ruled on the issue.
Setting aside these consent judgments, no court has ever found that any state's law violates the federal law that is being asserted here.
They were specifically targeting immigrants, people who were receiving those programs, because they said that they are discriminating against U.S. citizens.
Jordi Hualpa Uribe is a member of immigrant rights group COPAL's Youth Committee. He and Vivi Seeger, the Youth Committee coordinator, said the DOJ's case misses the real purpose of the DREAM Act, which serves not only undocumented students, but also those with temporary protected status.
You know, you could be a student with authorization, just not to receive federal aid. So you could be legally working or had your asylum application approved and you're just waiting for your social security number.
Last month, COPAL's Youth Committee invited State Attorney General Keith Ellison to a press conference, publicly thanking him for defending the state's programs.
We wrote a letter of gratitude to show appreciation of like the efforts that he's done for Minnesota, and that we're also watching.
The government shutdown has put the case on pause, and the DOJ was unavailable for comment. Still, COPAL's youth see the support from AG Ellison as a sign that they're not alone in their fight for opportunity.
We just need leaders who support us, support our students.
For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
listening to North Star Stories. Are you ready for Election Day? Polls are open Tuesday, November 4th from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. You can find your polling place on the Secretary of State's website. Campaigning is banned within 100 feet of the building, and voters may not wear political materials or display campaign messages. If your registration is current, you do not need an ID in Minnesota. And remember, you have the right to take time off of work to vote. For more information, visit mnvotes.gov.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
All things considered, I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Tanzania has been plunged into crisis after disputed elections and a bloody crackdown on protest. Activists say hundreds of people have been killed in the East African country since the incumbent president was declared the winner with 98% of the vote. Kate Bartlett reports.
There was plenty of pomp and ceremony at President Samia Suluhu Hassan's inauguration ceremony today, as she took the oath of office.
Mheshimiwa Rais Mteule wa Jamhuri ya Muungano wa Tanzania sasa anaelekea katika meza ya kiapo.
Mimi Samia Suluhu Hassan.
But there weren't any members of the public to whom the normally open event was closed. Hassan says that same public supported her in overwhelming numbers at the polls on October 29th. The opposition and videos of unrest on the street tell another story. Due to a nationwide internet shutdown, it's been difficult to get information from the ground. But Deogratias Munishi, spokesman for the largest opposition party, Chadema, spoke to NPR from Nairobi. Chadema was banned from contesting the elections. Its leader, Tundu Lissu, is currently on trial on treason charges. Rights groups reported numerous instances of torture, enforced disappearances, and extrajudicial killings in the run-up to the vote.
These elections were a completely illegitimate or they were a total sham.
Munishi said security forces have launched a deadly crackdown on Tanzanians protesting the election results.
Up until now, it has gone more than 1,000 deaths. Hospitals in Tanzania are overwhelmed by dead bodies.
Before his arrest in April, Lissu had been holding rallies around the country under the slogan, "No reforms, no elections." His American lawyer, Robert Amsterdam, says the opposition leader faces the death penalty if convicted of treason.
The situation in Tanzania is in a critical position. My client, Tundu Lissu, continues to languish in solitary confinement in jail for absolutely no reason other than his popularity, his credibility, and his integrity.
The government has rejected allegations excessive force has been used in the election period. Tanzania is one of several African countries to hold elections this year, some disputed, that have resulted in unrest. Last month, Cameroon saw the re-election of the world's oldest leader. In Ivory Coast, the president won a fourth term after barring opposition heavyweights from running. In 2021, when President Hassan first succeeded authoritarian leader John Magufuli, who was nicknamed the Bulldozer, many Tanzanians were hopeful the country was on a more democratic path. The first female president ushered in a number of reforms. Now, many say she's worse than her predecessor. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
In Austria, three nuns, all in their 80s, recently ran away from a nursing home. They broke into their former convent in defiance of church orders, determined to grow old on their own terms. These sisters are now taking Instagram by storm, and they're being supported by a growing community. In the first of two stories, Esme Nicholson reports from Salzburg.
Morning Mass is underway at the Chapel of Schloss Goldenstein, a convent nestled between the church spires of Salzburg and the arresting backdrop of the Alps. 82-year-old Sister Rita is delighted to see so many people in attendance. As Catholic congregation numbers dwindle in Austria, Rita says you'd expect the church to be equally thrilled by such a full chapel. But Rita and fellow sisters Regina and Bernadette are in the local provost's bad books. She says people are calling us rebellious sisters. The three Augustinian nuns are effectively squatting in the convent that used to be their home. Rita says they were taken to a nursing home against their will 2 years ago when church authorities shuttered the cloisters. But the sisters have no intention of hanging up their habits. They entered the convent on the understanding that they would serve there and at the adjoining school for the rest of their lives. So in September, a group of parishioners rented a U-Haul and, with the help of a local locksmith to get inside, moved the sisters back into the convent and switched the water and electricity back on. Sister Rita says they simply had to act.
I wanted to speak to the provost to tell him how unhappy we were, but we couldn't reach him. When the opportunity arose to return to our beloved convent, we didn't wait for his permission.
When they broke back in, Rita, Bernadette and Regina say their rooms looked as if they'd been ransacked and that their personal belongings, including letters and photographs, were all gone. But their superior, Provost Markus Kreisel, is not pleased with the sisters' descent. And when their getaway made headlines, he brought in a PR firm specialising in damage control. So Harald Schifflet now speaks on the clergyman's behalf.
Das wurde mit den Schwestern selbstverständlich besprochen.
It goes without saying that the sisters were consulted before being moved into the nursing home. And it's understandable that after decades of living and working in one place, such a move is not easy.
Schifflet adds that the provost was acting out of concern for the sisters and that the nearly empty convent was not suitable for their care needs in old age. But the sisters insist that they did not agree to leave. In the chapel, the pews creak as a latecomer joins the throng of worshippers eager to see the defiant nuns who've gone viral with their own Instagram account. Christina Wittenberger, one of the sisters' former students who helped plot their return, says they went public on purpose.
Auf Anraten wurde mir mitgeteilt, dass die Schwestern.
We invited the press along to prevent the provost from turfing the sisters out of the convent. I was told that he would not be so bold on camera.
65-year-old Wittenberger has known the sisters since she was 10. She says that while headstrong and as sharp as ever, they're also vulnerable. When other volunteers suggested launching an Instagram account, she said only on the condition the sisters gave their express permission. 88-year-old Sister Bernadette, who has been a nun here since 1955, takes social media stardom in her stride.
I think it's wonderful that Instagram brings people to us to praise God. Sure, they're curious to see us after all the press coverage, but what they see is our worship.
But Bernadette is still reeling about what happened. As she climbs four flights of stairs, she says the chairlift was removed from the cloister not long after her own removal.
I'd been in hospital for 2 weeks, and when I was discharged, I thought I was returning home to the convent. But the ambulance took me to a nursing home in my nightgown. I was shocked.
And that's when Sister Bernadette decided to rebel. Now, if disobedient Salzburg nuns ring a bell, tune in again for part two when we speak to a friend of Sister Bernadette, the granddaughter of Maria von Trapp, the one-time nun immortalised in Technicolor by Julie Andrews in the film The Sound of Music. For NPR News, I'm Esme Nicholson in Salzburg.
For 1,000 years, the hills fill my heart with the sound of music.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fidelity Investments. A dedicated advisor can help build a flexible wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. From the Kresge Foundation, with Pathbreakers, a podcast about transforming communities through innovation, from revolutionizing higher education to supporting artists who are driving change. Pathbreakers is available on podcast platforms. And from Drexel University, whose cooperative education program positions students to explore future careers before graduation. This is experiential education. More at drexel.edu.
Another hour is ahead of All Things Considered. 5:30, we've got the Up North Report. That's local news from our region. Today, an update on local sports, football, volleyball, and cross country. Support for programming this afternoon comes from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. You can learn more at watchictv.org. We do have increasing clouds tonight. Gusty west winds are pairing with dry conditions. This is leading to near critical fire weather conditions. For tomorrow, looks like a slight chance of some rain early, then cloudy skies, highs 50 to 54 degrees. This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org.